You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 22nd, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Is this you, John Wayne? Is this me? Hi, everyone.
Hey, Evan.
What's up?
Guess what I watched the other night?
Full Dinner Jacket?
Something with John Wayne.
Not quite. No. Well,
Full Metal Jacket, come on.
I don't think so. I've
Evan,
ever seen
how
that.
You haven't seen Full Metal Jacket?
Oh, wow. It is fantastic, Rebecca.
See, I poked the termites.
I'm not really into fashion stuff.
Fashion?
It's a war movie. Stanley Kubrick, come on.
It's a classic. It's a total.
Speaking of classics, let's talk about Precious Bodily Fluids.
Oh, I love that. Awesome.
On January 25th, 1945, Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first community in the world to add fluoride to their drinking water. It came about as a study to determine if the fluoride would improve the citizenry's dental health. There were several groupings of cities, and Grand Rapids was teamed up with Muskegon. Is that how you say it? Muskegon, Michigan? So Muskegon did not get any fluoride, and Grand Rapids did. And the researchers found that over the years, Grand Rapids showed a notable increase in health compared to Muskegon. And for the record, Muskegon did start fluoridating in 1951, which kind of screwed up the whole 10-year study. But still, the scientists determined that it helped enough that other cities around the country started fluoridating as well. That said, those early studies have been criticized by anti-fluoridation activists and academics like Mark Diesendorf, who wrote a 1984 article in Nature, in which he called those studies primitive and suggested that there were numerous problems with them that covered for the fact that fluoride might actually be harming the general population. But as for now, the consensus, at least legally and scientifically, seems to be that fluoridation is a net benefit. So it continues today.
There have been tons of studies since then. I mean, if you're going back, it's like saying, oh, Darwin didn't get everything right about evolution. You know, it's like, well, you know, some things have happened in the last 60 years, 70 years. There was a review in 1993, this was about 50 years after the fluoridation program, and showed a clear benefit of fluoridation and safety. And there have been numerous studies since then. A more recent review in 2012 looked at the quality of studies as well as how they were conducted and the effect sizes. And there's still a very clear signal of a significant reduction in dental caries with public fluoridation. Although the amount that the dental caries is being decreased is reduced, but that's only because the baseline dental health is better now than it was 60 years ago, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, fluoride toothpaste, for example. So there's just the gap is less. There's less of a need for it. But still, there's even with, you know, with modern toothpaste and everything, there is still a measurable benefit to fluoride. Do you know how it was first discovered? It's actually a really interesting story, how the whole fluoride connection was discovered. Researchers by the name of McKay and Black were trying to figure out the cause of Colorado brown tooth disease.
Mm. What's brown tooth disease?
Yeah, so it's actually, well, now we know that it's caused by fluorosis, by too much fluoride. But at the time they had no idea.
Whoa.
But they identified several communities in the United States where children were getting brown stains on their teeth. And they figured out that it was something in the water supply. Like in one town, it happened right after they built a pipeline to a new reservoir. And then they had them change their water supply and the brown teeth went away. So they knew it was something in the water. But until they did spectrographic analysis, they didn't know what it was. But then they eventually figured out that it was fluoride. But they also noticed at the same time that the brown stained teeth were remarkably resistant to dental caries, to getting cavities. And then, you know, to cut to the chase, eventually they figured out that it was, you know, fluoride was, had a protective effect and that there's a certain dose range where you get the benefits of reduction in dental caries without getting the fluorosis, or at least there's a minimal chance of getting any staining on the teeth, any of the fluorosis. That also highlights the fact that the fluoridation program is not just about adding fluoride to the water. It's about controlling the dose of fluoride in the water, right? Some communities have too much. And they actually remove fluoride from the public water supply. Some have too little based upon research indicating what the optimum level is. So it's the program is adjusting the level of natural fluoride that would otherwise be in water supplies that are used in public water supplies. The anti-fluoridation, you know, stuff is all propaganda. I mean, it's, they are as loony as the anti-vaccinationists. I mean, they're immune to data and logic. They're making emotional, propaganda-filled, you know, scaremongering about fluoride because, you know, it violates their precious bodily fluids.
Could you imagine if your thing was that you hate fluoride? Mm-hmm. You know, like that's what gets you out of bed in the morning. My other question / comment is, has there been any studies to show what happens to people that actively avoid fluoride? Like, do they actually have bad teeth, or, you know, is there something they can measure there?
That's the control group, right? That's somebody where there's no fluoride in the public water system. And I mean, you can't force people to like not brush their teeth, you know, not have good dental hygiene. But if you look at communities where there is low access to dental care and they don't have fluoride, yeah, they have, you know, much elevated rates of dental caries than communities that either have fluoride or that have good dental care, which, you know, brings up another point that fluoridation programs help the poor disproportionately. So the anti-fluoridation movements disproportionately hurt poor communities and poor families because those are the ones that need it the most.
I can't wait till they put nanites in the water. That's what I'm waiting for. Come on.
And what will they be doing to us?
Oh, just lots of good
whatever.
Stuff. It's a secret. Whatever. It's a secret. Yeah. Don't worry about it. Pretend I didn't say anything.
Nanites of their own initiative, their own programming. That would be cool.
Yeah, don't worry about the details. Let the government handle that.
Pay no attention to that creature in the water.
All right, Bob, tell us about the cosmic web.
Whoa. If you insist.
I do.
This is cool.
www.cosmicweb.
Astronomers have obtained the first direct images of a filament of the cosmic web of the universe. Now, doesn't cosmic web sound cool?
Is that the universal web of the cosmos?
What?
Okay, never mind.
Whatever. So I just like the term cosmic web because, yeah, I love spiders and astronomy, so I can't help but love it. But luckily they haven't found a cosmic arachnid yet. That would be kind of scary and cool at the same time. So this web that I'm talking about is primarily composed of what?
Dark matter.
Dark matter, yes. This dark matter gravitationally attracts all the hydrogen gas, which then surrounds and envelops the dark matter. And the dark matter, of course, is invisible, but it's these diffuse gas elements around the dark matter.
Bob, does it surround and penetrate the dark matter?
Surround, yes. Yes, I got that one. So it's this gas that's around the dark matter that has been seen for the first time. Nothing, you know, that's what we can see. Otherwise, we wouldn't even know about it. So, but the importance of these cosmic web filaments, it can't really be overstated. And I was kind of surprised at how amazing or how important they really are. It's thought that at the nodes where these filaments intersect is the only place where the gas can be dense enough to form things, like stars and galaxies. So without it, the universe would be very different. So of course, if you're thinking it, yes, our Milky Way galaxy formed in one of these nodes and pretty much all the galaxies that we see. So the journey to the discovery is an interesting one. It started with the attempt to make or to create a standard model of cosmology. Now that's, you know, obviously analogous to the standard model of physics. With a viable model of the cosmos that we can then simulate the universe and then more fully understand, you know, how it evolved to its current stage and what it may evolve to in the far future. So once this model was developed and sophisticated enough, then you could start running simulations, say on a supercomputer. And these simulations predicted that the universe should organize itself into this cosmic web structure. And, but you know, once they realized that, then they said, well, we got to find this stuff, but it's really difficult to directly image these filaments though. The dark matter and this diffuse cold regular matter are just so far away that up till now, we've only been able to detect them indirectly through methods like gravitational lensing, where light is bent by gravity and then focused. Thank you, Einstein. So, but, recently scientists from the University of California, Santa Cruz and the Max Planck Institute of Astronomy in Heidelberg, they spotted this web directly, using an entire quasar, as an impromptu spotlight. Quasars or quasi-stellar objects. They're the cores of very, very young, very, very distant galaxies with, ravenous black holes. Black hole cores, which consume everything around them. And the heat generated as the matter kind of swirls in the accretion disk into oblivion, essentially. It's so hot that it lights up the core, making them the brightest and therefore the most distantly observable things in the entire universe. So one quasar, about 10 billion light years away, though, was oriented in just the right way to light up a nearby gas cloud that's 2 million light years across. This cloud isn't just reflecting this light. It's actually glowing from the quasar's radiation, almost pretty much identical to a fluorescent lamp, the same way a fluorescent lamp glows. But this is still a very minute amount of light. So what the scientists did is they made these very special filters just for this task, which only transmit the very specific wavelengths emitted by the fluorescent gas. So once they put that into their instruments and checked it out, bam, there it was. So not only is this pretty cool in and of itself, but the astronomers noticed that this nebula that was lit up has about 10 times the gas that models predicted it would. And that was probably one of the biggest surprises that they encountered. So this is exactly the kind of information that we need to make our simulations more accurate, because we can never really fully understand galactic evolution unless we know as much as possible about how this gas is fed into the galaxies, you know, using these cosmic web filaments that kind of, you know, shuttles the gas around. So once we have a better understanding of how that works, then we'll have a better understanding of galactic evolution, and that's cool.
So, and Bob, would you say that this is one more independent piece of evidence that dark matter exists?
Yeah, I mean, there's really no question at this point, but yeah, I would. So my question is then, we know that these filaments are basically, outlining where a lot of dark matter is, probably most of the dark matter in the universe. So that's interesting to think that there are these huge kind of, use the word filaments again, of dark matter that are just all over the place.
Well, let's move on. Evan, we're going to turn to a little bit of a darker story. This is our somewhat unofficial series on how pseudoscience kills. It's another unfortunate exorcism escapade.
Yeah. These stories are just awful. I don't think there's any other way to describe it. One of the prevailing questions having anything to do with paranormal, pseudoscience, and quackery, all the things we talk about on this show, is what's the harm? Well, you know, life is an endless series of risk to benefit analysis, right? Everything from the mundane and everyday, like should I look both ways before I cross the street? And then there are some questions that maybe are not so obvious or don't have so obvious an answers, such as if I eat that mushroom in the woods, will it make me sick? Well, unless you know a lot about mushrooms, you know, you really are taking a big chance there. But when you boil it down, what's the harm? That's the question we're constantly left asking, and at least for those of us who care about the well-being of ourselves and other people. So when the Pope, and I just don't mean Francis, but, you know, any Pope, because they all seem to have done it, perform the rite of exorcism, you know, the harm is that you got a billion people on this planet who affiliate or associate themselves in some level with the Catholic Church. That was one out of every seven people. And they not only believe that demons, devils, and other fantastical creatures exist, but, you know, a lot of these people follow the tenets of the church. So they believe that this violent, abusive, torturous, and sometimes deadly act of carrying out an exorcism is some sort of legitimate practice. It's medieval. And as I'm fond of saying, medieval beliefs yield medieval results. And that's what we have this week. When I tell you that in Germantown, Maryland, which is about 20 miles north of Washington, D.C., a mother and an accomplice are being held on charges of first-degree murder for the stabbing death of her one-year-old and two-year-old children in what was being described as an exorcism they were performing on the children. And also injured were two other children aged 5 and 8. They escaped only with wounds, barely. According to Captain Marcus Jones of the Montgomery County Police Department, the mother had allegedly formed a group called Demon Assassins because she believed that by doing so, evil wouldn't take over their lives. And their purpose was to get rid of devils and evil spirits. Police are also searching for two other men who are believed to be members of this group as well. The latest on the story is that the two accused women are going for psychiatric, court-ordered psychiatric evaluation to see if they're competent to stand trial. It's awful. I mean, but who's being held to account here? I mean, how do these thoughts even enter a person's mind? You have to think, what does the local Catholic Church have to say about it, right? Or what about the church these people belong to? And actually, some news outfits did go out to the church that they belong to try to find out some questions. So we'll credit news outlet WHAG for finding this out. The mother and the four children used to attend the Maranatha Brethren Church on Scott Hill Drive in Hagerstown, Maryland. And they reached out to officials at the church who did not want to speak directly, but they did offer some words saying they were shocked and horrified at the murders. That was about it. The Baltimore Sun also got this bit of news. The pastor at the Maranatha Brethren Church in Hagerstown told the Washington Post that members of the church drove the woman to mental health sessions during the time she was living there. So apparently they, I don't know, knew something was amiss, or, you know, why else would they be driving her to mental health sessions? Or not, right? They knew this woman had serious issues. What do you do when the tenants of your church, you know, and this is a group of church, and I looked up a little bit more about this particular church, and they're part of sort of this very conservative set of churches, or larger sets of congregations that exist in the country, and they're considered certainly more on the conservative side, which means, you know, adhering to strict Catholic doctrine, and exorcism is definitely part of that. At the same time, you know, so at what level does this church have a responsibility as to what's going on? I'm not saying that they're to blame for this directly, you know, but they clearly knew something was wrong with this woman. And, you know, I don't know. They just don't do her any, they don't do people like this any favors by exposing them to things like exorcisms, the concept of exorcisms, and, you know, not properly telling people to really avoid these things, because all it is a modern form of torture.
Yeah, these stories are always tricky because you never know, like, what the interaction was between any pre-existing mental illness and the belief in exorcism. But certainly telling somebody who maybe has some mental health issues that demonic possession exists is like handing them a loaded gun. You know what I mean? It may not be the sole cause of the action that they take, but it certainly is not helpful. And oftentimes, and I've seen this directly myself in cases that I've been involved with investigating, where the people who believe in exorcism, actually, they're playing into and endorsing the delusions of people who are mentally ill, who have like a psychotic disorder.
Yeah, but Steve, they suffer from the same delusion.
You know, it's different when somebody just has a religious belief system versus somebody who has an independently diagnosable mental illness. These are two different situations. So you have, you know, the former case, somebody just has a religious belief in demonic possession, telling somebody who has schizophrenia that, no, they or their family members really are possessed by demons, and that they're going to do a ritual of exorcism to endorse their belief. It's like telling a schizophrenic that, yeah, the CIA really is monitoring your thoughts through the fillings in your teeth.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
That's the worst thing that you can do to somebody with a delusional disorder is to tell them that their delusions are real. This case is still early. We don't know the full details about what diagnosis they may have had, and, you know, how bad were they, and how much the mental illness versus the religious beliefs were playing a role in their behavior. But, you know, I do think that you're right, Evan, that this is the downstream harm that occurs when you instill these kind of beliefs in a community. There's going to be somebody out there, you know, who's going to respond in this way.
Also, yeah. In what rite of exorcism are knives involved?
Exactly. I mean,
my question. Where did that come from?
I think they got that out of The Omen.
Oh, yeah.
You mean the movie?
Yeah, the movie The Omen. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, you laugh, but so much of this stuff really is based on and influenced by popular media and pop culture.
Sure.
I was just reading an article about exorcisms in Mexico and how Catholic priests are saying that they're helping cure gang violence in Mexico through exorcisms. And I won't go into it all here, but I have a YouTube video on it coming out this week if you want to learn more. But the priest the journalist talks to says something along the lines of how scary it was to have some guy who was possessed by a demon and how it sounded exactly like in the movies. Well, yeah, of course it did, because they're mimicking the things that they see in movies, whether they know it or not. That's their influence.
Yeah. It's true. That's right, Rebecca. There's this interplay between popular culture and these kind of belief systems. It's like UFOs, too, the whole UFO mythology.
Yeah.
There's an interplay with science fiction and UFO movies, et cetera. They sort of feed off of each other to the point where it becomes difficult to separate.
The feedback loop, yeah.
But isn't it true that a lot of the pop culture thing is what actually introduces and makes people become interested in a lot of these ideas? I mean, like as an example, when Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out, that really sparked a massive interest in UFOs.
Yeah. And the movie The Exorcist did the same for exorcism. It had the same effect. So yeah, you're right. Often there, you know, it takes on a orders of magnitude larger role.
Damn you, Blatty.
It was a cool movie, though.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's move on. Let's move on.
Jay cannot watch that movie to this day.
This is Nexus.
Nexus 2014. This year, we have an incredible lineup. With keynote speaker Lawrence Krauss, Katie Coleman, Paul Offit, Elsie Andrew from I F***ing Love Science, live performance from the Skeptics Guide, our pre-conference Friday workshops, stimulus response and drinking skeptically. Nexus 2014. Go to necss.org and register today.
Rebecca, I understand that some scientists have finally solved a burning scientific mystery.
That's right. It's about hemorrhoids. Mm-hmm. No. zing. I got this from a number of people sent this news item to me because apparently I have mentioned in the past my childhood fascination with a thing called ball lightning. Ball lightning is this mysterious phenomenon that has been reported for centuries from eyewitness accounts, but never directly observed in the wild in a scientific way. And what ball lightning is a glowing orb anywhere from the size of a golf ball to several meters in length, floating through the air, sometimes blowing through windows, going through doors. Historically, it seems like ball lightning attacks churches a lot. There are a lot of really creepy stories of churches with full congregations encountering ball lightning. The ball will float in. If it touches someone, it may electrocute them. It often kills them. And it can just sort of fade away, or it can explode with a very loud noise, blowing out windows and knocking people to the ground. It can be any color. So, you know, with a phenomenon as rare and as wildly different from case to case as this, it's understandable that for a long time, researchers were very skeptical that it was even a real thing. Maybe it was just something like UFO encounters or ghosts where people are hallucinating or seeing other natural phenomena and not understanding what it is. So
swamp gas.
Swamp gas, yeah. But in the last couple of decades, I think, the evidence has amassed to the point that I think for the most part, scientists have accepted the idea that ball lightning could be a real phenomenon. But for the first time, it has been captured on camera. Chinese researchers led by Ping Yuan at Northwest Normal University were using high-speed video cameras and spectrographs to observe just regular lightning in a thunderstorm near Qinghai. And completely by chance, they captured a regular lightning strike followed by what appeared to be ball lightning as it was happening just about a kilometer away or about half a mile. In this case, the glow from the ball lightning spread to a completely incredible 5 meters, so about 15 feet wide, although they say that the ball itself was a bit smaller. And it traveled up about 3 meters, 15 feet, and then horizontally about 10 meters, a little more than 30 feet, before it disappeared. And it only lasted about 1.6 seconds, but they captured it on these high-speed cameras, and they've slowed down the footage. You can see it online if you are good with the Googling, or check the notes, I guess. The video is not impressive. It just looks like... No, it's really unimpressive. It looks like a fuzzy white ball on a completely black
fuzzy
background.
Warble.
Yeah.
Totally disappointing.
If you need that fix, there are some way cooler, way freakier bits of footage of what might possibly be ball lightning all over YouTube. There are some really cool shots, and some of them, to my completely uneducated eye, looked for sure like they were ball lightning. But yeah, this one, not so visually interesting. But what makes it interesting is the data that the scientists got from the spectrographs, which showed that for the entirety of the ball lightning's short life, it was composed of silicon, iron, and calcium, which are the same elements that are found in soil. And that's notable because one of the most popular theories that scientists have about ball lightning is that it happens when lightning hits the soil and vaporizes some of the silicates. Sand is an example of a silicate. It's what makes up the majority of the Earth's crust, silicates. And so then a chemical reaction occurs in which the carbon strips the silicates of oxygen, creating a gas of silicon atoms, which then recombine to form nanoparticles. Hooray! The nanoparticles react with the oxygen to then emit the heat and light that we see as ball lightning. So that was the theory. And the Chinese scientists' spectrograph recordings lend credence to that theory. There's one thing that they couldn't confirm was, which was the existence of aluminum in the ball, which would have further strengthened their case since there's a good deal of aluminum in the soil. But unfortunately, the researchers' equipment wasn't capable of detecting the wavelengths that aluminum would have produced. So this isn't conclusive proof that that's what ball lightning is, that that's how it's produced. But it is the first major scientific observation of ball lightning occurring in nature. So it's pretty much the greatest thing ever to happen in ball lightningology. The researchers do plan to try to reproduce what they saw in laboratory conditions in order to find out more. There have been ongoing studies over the past few decades of ball lightning in the lab. You can even do it at home. Don't do this, but... Absolutely do not do this. But it's very easy.
You just said you can do this at home. Don't do this.
Absolutely do not do this. But it's very easy to do. All you need is a microwave and a match and a glass jar. You can figure it out the rest. Just look on YouTube.
Cool.
Don't do it. Yeah. Do not do it. But it's awesome.
And you didn't get the idea from SGU.
You did not hear it here. So anyway,
it was all a dream.
Scientists have been making ball lightning in the lab for quite a long time, but now they have the opportunity to try to reproduce what has actually been observed in nature in the hopes of better understanding what ball lightning really is.
They're saying that even though they did not have any way to directly measure the temperature, they estimate that it was 15,000 to 30,000 degrees centigrade. Boy, that's hot. Why haven't we heard more about, fire damage, heat damage?
Right. Even for a second and a half, that would.
But it could be diffuse, Bob. It could be that hot, but very diffuse.
Oh, that gambit. I hear you. Damn it. Okay.
And historically, You know, you do see some amount of very concentrated heat damage, destruction of, you know, the windows that it passes through and things like that. But generally, it's like floating through the air very quickly, and it's not so usually touching things.
Yeah.
I have been so fascinated by it for so long that, and we used to get some really fierce storms where I grew up, and every time there was a thunderstorm, I would wait by the window for like this eerie sphere to float through and murder someone, and it never did. I was always so disappointed.
So Rebecca, you're saying that ball lightning is your great pumpkin.
Yeah. It's my white whale or my great pumpkin, depending on your literature of choice. Right. Yeah. I was reading up on it today, and I was reminded in one of the articles I was reading, I think the first place I ever read about it was when I was little. I read the entire Little House on the Prairie series. And Laura Ingalls Wilder actually writes about an instance of ball lightning in which it floats into the kitchen and the mother like sweeps it back out. And Wilder claims that, you know, though it's historical fiction, she claims that all of the things that happen in the books are based on real events. So that's apparently one of the earliest examples of it appearing in fiction. And yeah, I think that that's what initially freaked me out was that book.
All right, Jay, we were all sad to hear about the end of the primary mission of the Kepler planet hunting satellite, but the story may not be quite over yet. Get us up to date.
Hopefully it isn't over. So Kepler is a space observatory launched on March 7th, 2009 by NASA with a mission to discover Earth-like planets orbiting other stars. Kepler was named after Renaissance astronomer Johann Kepler, who was known for his laws of planetary motion. These are not the laws of robotics. Don't get confused, Bob.
But there are three laws.
The astrophysics division at NASA has invited the Kepler project to submit a proposal that, if approved, would fund more missions for the observatory, and it would be named K2. Pretty cool. The new missions would continue to search for exoplanets and introduce some other celestial bodies to observe. Now, NASA's request, this happens every 2 years. NASA has a senior review process that evaluates the cost versus benefits of extending the life or retasking hardware that has completed its original mission. So Kepler is perfect for this, except that Kepler was fatally wounded. The Kepler team is working hard on their proposal, which is due January 31st, 2014, and the fate of the K2 mission will be decided by summertime 2014. But what's going on here? How could they possibly use Kepler if it's you know, screwed up? If it lost two of its four gyros, how is it this thing going to maneuver itself? So the team has to prove
it's pronounced gyros. Just kidding. Just a sandwich joke. Continue.
The team has to prove that they can maneuver Kepler with its two remaining gyros. So in May of 2013, Kepler lost the second of four gyroscopes, and these are, like, you could also call them reaction wheels. What these are used to do is maneuver the ship to an absolute pinpoint precision. And you need to have that type of precision, and you need to sustain that type of precision to take these photographs that they take, because they take them over time, and it's observing change over time as well.
83 days.
So that's right, Steve. Good one. The sun's photons actually push spacecraft, and this is the problem. With it being down to two gyros, the sun's photons actually push it off kilter, and they can't maintain the position that they need to. So even though these are small nudges, when an observatory is taking pictures, it has to be just amazingly still. The loss of that second gyroscope, so they were down to two from four original gyroscopes, made it so Kepler could no longer function to take images. Or so everyone thought. So what the engineers at Kepler Mission and Ball Aerospace have come up with is pretty freaking amazing. In order to stabilize the spacecraft, they are maneuvering it so the solar pressure is evenly distributed on its surface. It's described as using the sun as a third gyroscope. Are you kidding me?
So Jay, this is how I understood it when I investigated this. It's not so much that they're using the solar radiation as a gyroscope. It's that one of the three gyroscopes was dedicated to compensating for this pressure from the solar wind, right? From the solar radiation, I should say. And by positioning the satellite so that the solar radiation falls on it symmetrically, they're essentially just eliminating the need for that third gyroscope. Does that make sense? So that there won't be any net force that they'll need the third gyroscope to compensate for.
Yeah, but Steve, when you need four gyroscopes, you mean you got roll, pitch, and yaw. So wouldn't a fourth one be for the solar?
I guess they only need two to compensate for the satellite's orbital motion. And they needed the third for the solar pressure. And then the fourth was
a backup?
Extra. It was a backup. Yeah, but then that's why when they lost two, they no longer could function. So there's a diagram on the NASA site that goes over all of it. We'll link to that. I think visually it's easier to understand that's how they explain how they're getting around only having two gyroscopes. They're just eliminating the solar force as a variable. So they don't need that third gyroscope.
Cool. So they're testing Kepler right now. They're actually putting it through some maneuvers. They're testing their hypothesis to make sure that it's actually going to work. And I think that they're already getting some early results. And things are looking good, but they need to really get down to the nitty-gritty to find out if the proposal is going to be worthwhile or not. And we won't find out, like I said, until this year, you know, 2014 summer. So it would be a little while wait, but imagine if they repurpose Kepler and we're starting to get images from it again. That would be phenomenal. I would love that.
It's cool. Wow.
As a quick, back interesting side note, I think we said this on the show before, but of the 4 years of data collected by Kepler, over a year's worth is still left to analyze. So this means that there is a ton of discoveries yet to be made, and hopefully more to come if the funding comes in. So good luck, Kepler.
Yeah, Jay. In fact, what I read was that their preliminary results show that with this new technique, they're getting to within 5% of the accuracy of when they had three gyros working.
Wow.
So yeah, just cool. A 5% loss. So that's apparently enough that they could function. So. All right. Well, thanks, Jay. One more news item. This one's a frustrating item. An excellent article, though. An excellent article written by Zach Coplin on Slate, exposing a scandal in the Texas public school system. So a lot of states, including Texas, have what are called charter schools. So these are independently run schools run by private, organizations. They're not run by the state, but they're funded by the state.
And they're still public schools.
And they're public schools. So, yeah. So it's just like the public school system contracting out, you know, specific schools. But they're supposed to be supervised by the public school system in the state. Well, there's a company that is running 65 different charter schools in Texas, Arkansas, and Indiana.
With 20 more coming in 2014.
More coming, called Responsive Ed. And essentially, they are using the charters, they're exploiting the charter system in order to teach Christian fundamentalism and creationism in these charter schools, even though they're publicly funded and are supposed to be held to the same constitutional standard as any public school, meaning you can't teach religion, you know, and you certainly can't teach creationism as if it were science. But that's exactly what they're doing. And what Coplin did was a good job of investigating the background of this company and the people involved. And it's clearly just a front for a Christian religious school organization. There are ties all over the place with Advanced Christian Education, ACE. It's an organization that provides Christian education for homeschooling, essentially teaching creationism instead of evolution and teaching what they consider to be, you know, conservative Christian values. This goes beyond teaching creationism, by the way, as well. So, for example, in the educational material that Coplin obtained through a Freedom of Information, I guess I don't know if it was an FOI request or just if you make a request, it's a public school, they have to give you their curriculum. So he got their curriculum, and it's like all of the familiar creationist tropes, saying things like evolution is just a theory, that some scientists question the validity of the conclusions about the age of the Earth or whatever. They pulled this ploy where they say that they question the age of the Earth and the geological columns because there is no single sample that shows every single geological column. You know, you understand what that means? Which is true, but irrelevant because you have multiple overlapping samples, so you can put them in sequence.
Like tree rings with dendrochronology. It's the same thing. You know, we don't have one tree sample of tree rings to go back, you know, arbitrarily far, but because when you they overlap and you can put them together and then you can have, you know, the tree rings going back much, you know, really far.
Yeah. So, they also, again, going beyond creationism, use a resource material that is littered with historical revisionism, with a very, again, like a conservative Christian viewpoint. For example, describing feminists as, I mean, look at the exact phrase. You're going to love this, Rebecca. Did you read this whole article?
No.
That feminists, you know, created a class of women who, are dependent on the government as their surrogate husband. About President Franklin Roosevelt, this one book that they're using says, the New Deal had not helped the economy. However, it ushered in a new era of dependency on the federal government.
You know, it's fine to bash feminists, but I will not stand for bashing FDR.
So, again, whatever end of the political spectrum you're on, the schoolroom should not be used for political or religious indoctrination. You know, even if you agree with that take on FDR, you still shouldn't, in my opinion, endorse the teaching of something so blatantly politicized in a primary education. You know, the classroom should be teaching consensus and should be as ideologically and politically neutral as possible. You know, this is an end run around the Constitution is what this is. They're using public funds to pay for public school education, but they're exploiting the loose supervision of this charter system in order to teach religious and ideological indoctrination in the public schools. All right, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thank you, Steve, and I will play for you last week's Who's That Noisy, as I am wont to do usually, and this week is no exception, so here we go.
Interesting one.
Mushrooms. Ooh. The hissing mushrooms.
The hissing mushrooms. Is that like spreading spores?
Yeah, that's what it's doing is it's, you know, pumping out spores. That's so cool.
Oh, my God.
So it's the sound of a mushroom coming. That's what you're saying.
I suppose so. They're kind of, I guess, shooting DNA around the world. The specific type of mushroom here is called Ernula caterium. Also known as devil's urn. And it's a cup fungus. You see pictures of this online. And sure enough, you know, out of the little cups under the right circumstances, you get that nice little poof and there go the spores.
Take a deep breath and you're good. It turns you into a zombie, right?
It does turn you into a zombie or something like it. And let's see, this was sent in by a listener who asked me to give specific credit to someone else from where they got it. So I told him I would definitely do that. So her name, she gets credit, Gabriella Sarvejka. And she listens to the show as well. Michael Gill also brought this to my attention, but he says it's Gabriella's find. So Gabriella, thank you very much for submitting that. And we did have a correct answer, a correct guess, only one. So Bill Tyler this week, listener, you are this week's winner. Well done. You must know something about mushrooms that the rest of our listeners know absolutely nothing about.
All right, Evan, and what do you got for this week?
And we'll get to it right now. A very specific noisy this week. WTN at theskepticsguide.org is the email, or go ahead and post it on the forums, sguforums.com. And as I say every week, and I do mean it from the bottom of my heart, Good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan. All right, we have a great interview coming up with Karen Stolz now in a few minutes, but first we're going to do just a quick name that logical fallacy. This one is based on a question from Julian, who's writing us from Ohio, and Julian asks, what kind of logical fallacy is it when a person argues against something on the basis of what the consequences would be as a result of the point being true? Say, for example, Donald tells his physician that hamburgers can't be bad for him since hamburgers are tasty and it would suck for hamburgers to make him chubby-wubby. All right, thanks for the question, Julian. So we do like to chat about specific logical fallacies. I don't know if I've mentioned it explicitly before, but the kind of logical fallacies that we're generally talking about are called informal logical fallacies. They're ones in which there is a bit of logic which is not necessarily true. So the conclusion does not follow from the premises. In this case, Donald concludes that hamburgers can't be bad for you because I like to eat them. You guys know what the name of that specific logical fallacy is?
No, I do not.
This one's pretty straightforward. It's the argument from final consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's it.
I love it when they name a fallacy after exactly what it is.
Right. Yeah. It's not after like somebody.
I would have got it if I was paying attention.
Sure.
So for example, I think I could come up with a creationist example for every logical fallacy that exists. My creationist example for this one is evolution is not true because if it were, people would behave immorally, right? If we are just a part of nature and we are not the divine creation of God, then we have no basis for morality. All right. Well, even if that were true, which it isn't, so I think that's a false premise, but even if it were, it doesn't follow that evolution is therefore not true. You know, the universe doesn't care about us and things can be true that don't have happy implications. You know, what you think are happy implications for you or your worldview. Yep, the argument from final consequences. All right, thanks, Julian. All right, guys, well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Karen Stolz. Now, Karen, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
And you are joining us this evening to talk about your latest book, God Bless America. But you are the author of previous books, including Haunting America, and you are a writer and speaker and science communicator and promoter of skeptical values. So tell us about your new book, God Bless America. What's the book about?
Okay, well, it's about strange and unusual religious beliefs and practices, and I kind of focus on some of the minority groups in this country as well. So I made a point of looking at beliefs and practices that are around today and being practiced now. So I looked at groups like the fundamentalist Mormons and the Amish and Mennonites, charismatics and Pentecostals and voodoo, Satanism, lots of different topics.
Did you encounter a lot of Satanists, did you?
No. I mean, they pretty much keep to themselves. And a lot of these groups are closed societies too, certainly the fundamentalist Mormons and Amish and Mennonites. But Satanists, they really – I don't think too many of them actually practice their rituals either. It's just more kind of membership to a club, bragging rights maybe.
It's kind of like an affectation. It's not like a really serious religion, you think?
Yeah, and I think many wouldn't actually classify it as a religion, and most of them are non-theist or atheists. There are very few actual devil worshippers out there.
Yeah, didn't Satanism begin as a satirical look at Christianity anyway?
Well, there are different groups, but with the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey started that back in the 60s. Yeah. And so that was more mocking Christianity more than about devil worship. I mean, they are atheists, right, and humanists and free thinkers and skeptics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there – is there anybody who actually believes the devil exists and worships the devil?
Well, there have been claims of many different societies historically of people who did practice devil worship. And just in investigating those groups or the claims, none of them actually existed. So if you have a look online, you will find the odd person out there here and there who is practicing devil worship. And really, it's just the antithesis of Christianity. So they pray and they have rituals and spells to Satan instead of to God. But they're just few and far between, these theistic Satanists.
Yeah, there's no like organized underground of satanic cults or anything.
No, no. As much as people fear that, and of course with the satanic panic in the 1980s and all of those claims, it's just they do not exist.
Was there anything in researching the book that surprised you? Did you uncover any cults or religious movements that you didn't know about before you started researching the book?
No, I'd heard of most of these groups, and I think I was fascinated with them coming from Australia. A lot of them aren't practiced in Australia. You're just not going to find many of them there. So I wanted to really experience them myself and find out more about them, and was in the perfect country to be able to do that. But I didn't come across anything that I hadn't heard of before, but certainly was able to bust a lot of myths and stereotypes about these groups. I think we all have these understandings or ideas about these people and what they practice and what they believe. And so I was able to bust some of those myths.
Give us some examples. What were the common myths that you found were not true?
Oh, I think maybe with the Amish and the Mennonites, we tend to think of them as just being these perfect people who create quilts and bake apple pies and
raise barns. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, barn raisings and stuff like that. And we think that there's no kind of underbelly, that they're very good, pure and simple people. And just in researching them, there's just there are a lot of problems inherent to their closed societies. And they I don't know if you've heard of puppy mills before.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
So they're guilty of things like that. And certainly, unfortunately, there's a lot of rape and incest that takes place in some of the communities too. And it's just kind of hushed up. I think that they like to deal with these problems internally. They don't like to they're very isolated in the way that they live too. And so they don't like to deal with our authorities. And they're just rather forgive people and forget and turn the other cheek. So there is an underbelly, unfortunately. But of course, a lot of people seen shows like Amish Mafia and mm-hmm. so they're aware of that. Even though some of those people aren't really practicing, or they didn't actually become Amish. To actually join the society, you need to be baptized as an Anabaptist. And you do that around the age of 16, maybe into the early 20s. And so most of those kids in those shows didn't actually become baptized.
The Amish is one of those things where the public has this image of them that's probably based mainly on the movies.
Yes.
And
mostly Witness.
But mostly the movie Witness.
Oh, yeah,
exactly.
The love story. Uh-huh. Harrison Ford.
Directed by Peter Weir.
But the reality is it never holds up, you know, to those kind of movie images.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's often the case. You know, same thing with voodoo as well. And you think of some of the movies like White Zombie and the fears that people have about just zombies and magical spells and things, and the reality isn't quite that way.
So tell us a little bit about voodoo. What is the reality there?
Well, it is practiced today, and it's gone through many different forms. It's come to the United States from countries like Haiti, but originally from West Africa. And there are a number of Afro-Caribbean religions, like Santeria. You may have heard that too. That's becoming more popular in the States. And there are about 1 million people practicing voodoo in the States today, which I was very surprised to find that out, with a lot of refugees from Haiti, and certainly a lot of people just in this country who are fascinated with it. And you've got different forms of voodoo too. Not only have you got people who've come over from other countries and are practicing it a certain way, maybe more traditionally, you've got Louisiana voodoo, which is more of a commercial style. And of course you have people online who are peddling all kinds of voodoo and claiming that they can create magical spells to cure cancer and stuff like that for a cost, for a fee. So normally if you pray within the system of voodoo to a spirit and you try to petition them for something, you will give them something in return, some kind of offering. But online, of course, these voodoo masters and voodoo kings and princes, they're charging money, often thousands of dollars.
It's really just their version of faith healing.
A lot of it is. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of folk medicine in voodoo and in hoodoo as well, which is kind of folk magic.
My understanding of voodoo is that it's essentially a fusion of Western African religious beliefs and
yes.
Catholicism.
Yes, it is. It's called syncretization, where you have religions that are blended together. And so when West African slaves and Haitian slaves came here, they were often forced by the Code Noir to become Catholic, usually within about a week of arriving in the States. And so to protect themselves, they became Catholic for all intents and purposes, and to protect their religion, they adopted various facets of Catholicism. So in that way, a lot of their spirits have syncretized with Catholic saints. And they've just incorporated more than just Catholicism too. There are aspects of Pentecostalism and charismatic beliefs and Freemasonry. Even Native American belief systems have just been blended in with voodoo. So it's not like other religions in that they have a particular doctrine and a church. It's really, in many ways, whatever goes. And you've got kids with candle-burning books through to people who practice mambos and hoogans that consider themselves to be priests and priestesses, do it professionally.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that's the equivalent of the Bible that is a source of doctrine?
There isn't. There isn't. There are lots of spells which are passed down, and it's all oral tradition by and large.
And how far inside did you get to the religions that you were investigating, like, for example, like Scientology? You apparently, your chapter on Scientology was praised by Richard Dawkins, and he thought it was a very good treatment. But so how far did you actually get to talk to some people who were pretty high up in the church?
Well, it was different with every religion. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these are closed societies. And with the advent of the internet, a lot of information is really coming out for groups like Scientology and for the fundamentalist Mormons too. We're getting the meat at the same time as the milk. So the good stuff and the bad stuff. So some of them are harder to penetrate than others, but a whole point of the book was I wanted to have an experience with these people, and I wanted to not only research them and do armchair research, but to actually go and participate and get involved with them. So with Scientology, of course, they're more than willing to have someone come in off the streets, but they were kind of surprised, I think. Normally they're having to drag people in with the lure of a free personality test and various other things, and I just walked in off the street on a Sunday morning wanting to go to one of their services, and they thought, what the hell's going on here? And they were kind of a bit suspicious of me, and at one point I had a fellow just approach me and take a photograph of me and then disappear. Didn't ask me for my permission. He just did it and disappeared. And so it seemed like they weren't prepared for someone to come in and actually want to go to one of their services. And there were people everywhere, auditors and various other staff members. And I just don't even know if they had a service planned as such. But I ended up speaking with a fellow there, and he showed me around, and they've got this, it looks like a Barnes & Noble or something in there. They've got all of these videos and things about, and books and just merchandise. And then this fellow came back a little bit later, and he had a cross. He was wearing a cross on his vest. So suddenly he's the minister. And I sat through this very bizarre service where he was reading L. Ron Hubbard's stories as sermons. And it was kind of like an auditing session too. And I think there were a lot of hypnosis was coming into play, and he was just telling me, ordering me to do these various things. And I think to get me into this kind of hypnotic state of suggestibility, where I guess I would go and purchase books and DVDs and things. But was just really bizarre. And I said to him as well, you've got so many people here. Why aren't they attending the service? And he said, oh, they're busy. They're working. And he said later on that they have one family who will normally turn up on a Sunday. So this was a legitimate Church of Scientology service, but I just don't think they really get the numbers as a rule. So I took them by surprise. It was really weird. They had busts of him everywhere, which was kind of like, you know, Mussolini, just very, very strange. And of course, he did claim he had this thing called Tone 40. I don't know if you guys have heard of that before, but it was a particular tone of voice. It does. A particular tone of voice that you could use to command someone to come back to life. And so I really do think he's kind of they've set him up as a bit of a Jesus figure.
So they're still working on that, achieving the Tone 40 thing. They think they're going to bring him back.
Yeah, it wasn't successful with him, was it? But he claims that he'd brought babies back from the dead and that other people had used this before. You needed to have a very commanding voice and order the person to come back and that it could work.
Picturing L. Ron Hubbard drunk and shouting at a dead person. Get up!
As you know, I mean, he was very much against psychology and psychotherapies and psychiatry, and yet when he died, they found he was full of, anti-anxiety agents and antidepressives and other drugs.
Well, Karen, thanks. It's a fascinating book. We really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Thank you.
We appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Oh, yeah.
I was hatched ready.
Jay, you're still working off your perfect record for the year so far. 3 for 3, right?
I believe you are correct, sir.
All right, well, here we go. Item number one, a new study finds that even positive civil comments can undermine the effectiveness of online public service announcements. Item number two, scientists find that taking fever-reducing medication when sick with the flu increases the spread of the disease and leads to more flu-related deaths. And item number three, a new analysis concludes that U.S. carbon emissions can be reduced by 40% if all passenger vehicles by 2050 were fully electric. Evan, go first.
Positive civil comments can undermine the effectiveness of online public service announcements. How would it undermine it? Public service announcements? Those are kind of neutral in themselves. I'm not sure about that one. But the next one, fever-reducing medication when sick with the flu increases the spread of the disease. So if this one's true, what's probably going on here then leads to more flu-related deaths. Oh, wow. I don't know about that. See, that's the tricky part here. Flu-related deaths. I wouldn't be surprised if it increased the spread of the disease, but I'm not sure you can say it really leads to more flu-related deaths. But I suppose if it's going to add to anything, yeah, it would be, you know, deaths. It would affect that category as well. Last one. About the new analysis of U.S. carbon emissions. If I knew my ratios of how much carbon emissions vehicles are responsible for, I would have an easier time figuring this out, but I don't know that off the top of my head. I think we like to think that cars are the biggest source of pollution out there, but I think there are too many other things that create the carbon emissions, and I think that the passenger vehicles ones, although it would affect it, reduced by 40%, that number seems to be too high. I think we're giving too much blame to the automobiles for the entire carbon emissions problem. So I'm going to say that one, carbon emissions, reduced by 40%, electric cars, 2050, is the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, the one about the positive civil comments can undermine the effectiveness. I agree with Evan. That's kind of hard to comment on. Why would positive comments undermine the effectiveness of online public service announcements? Maybe because it makes people think it's, if anything, it would just make people think it's fake. That's weird. Okay. The second one, scientists say that taking the fever-reducing medication when sick. I think this one is science, and I'll say the reason being that I think people will leave because they feel better after their fever goes down. When you take, like, for example, Advil cold and sinus, like, that usually works really well on me. And even though I'm not better, it makes me feel better enough where I might go to work. And then you get more people sick. So I think that one is definitely science. And the last one, This is another one. I feel like I know a little bit about, like, about the reduced emissions by 40%. I don't think it's going to be 40%. I think that's huge. The problem is how are we generating the electricity? If we're generating the electricity with fossil fuels, it's not going to change much. If we're generating the electricity with, you know, photovoltaic cells and everything, great, but we're not close enough to doing that yet. We're not there yet. Other than, like, the first one, I just don't know. This one I kind of have a beef with, so I'm going to say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob? The civil comments, I'm not sure what to think about that one. It makes me think of, we talked a couple times about certain messages, like skeptical messages, and how they're, you know, how they're phrased can have a huge impact on how people understand them. Or like if it was a skeptical comment about a paranormal event or belief, the way you phrase it can have a big impact. And it seemed counterintuitive. Some of it was counterintuitive. Maybe that's coming into play here. I'm not sure. That one's actually really tough. The medication one and fever, that just makes a lot of sense to me. I actually, Jay is, I think is correct that, yeah, you're feeling better. So you're going to be out and about infecting more people. And I think there might be another component to that. I mean, fever, we have fevers for a reason, people. I mean, your body just doesn't want to make you uncomfortable. It actually has a benefit. By prematurely taking down your fever, there's a little extra inherent risk, I think, in that. And that could play into it. So I believe that we could see an increase in flu-related deaths because of that. The third one, the carbon emissions, yeah, it seems too high. This specifically says passenger vehicles. It doesn't talk about any other type of vehicle. Trucks, how many trucks are out there? And other vehicles and machines that spew out carbon emissions. And Jay had a great point about the battery, and that's absolutely true. It didn't occur to me, but it's clear that if you push back the electricity generation back a step, what difference does it really make? So I'm going to say that one's fiction too. And Rebecca.
Yeah. I was thinking in, okay, so for positive civil comments thing, that is weird that it would undermine the effectiveness of online PSAs. I'm trying to think of any PSAs I've ever seen online. And
good point.
I can't, like, I'm trying to imagine this and I just really am having trouble with it. So all I can think of is, okay, so there's like a blog post, say, like where somebody's like, I don't know, stop bullying or something, you know, bullying hurts people. Maybe it's something where, I don't know, there's been plenty of studies that show that internet comments are just bad for science. And yeah, they're mixed. Who knows, really? But in general, it seems like, when you are trying to convey a specific message, you don't want to muddy it up with a bunch of other people's dumb opinions. Like, that seems to be the trend. So I can kind of see that one being true. For the fever reducing one, I was thinking along the same lines as Bob, where fever is something that, you know, happens for a reason. I read ages ago, and this might be completely wrong, but it was something along the lines of like a higher temperature makes it more difficult for viruses to propagate. Like they can't survive at that kind of temperature, and that's why we get fevers. But I don't know. That might have been complete BS. So maybe that's what it is. And the carbon emissions thing reduced by 40%, that's a huge amount. And to me, the biggest, cars are a huge problem, yes, but we also have airplanes, which are an even bigger problem than cars by a long shot from what I've heard. We have coal power plants, you know, things like that. So 40% is, I think, way too high. So I'm going to go with that one as the fiction.
All right. You all agree on number three, so let's take these in order. Item number one, a new study finds that even positive civil comments can undermine the effectiveness of online public service announcements. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay.
Woo-hoo.
All right.
I mean, bad for the public
service. So what does it do? It makes people less confident or less alarmist about what they're trying to really say.
Well, they don't know. The study wasn't designed to answer the question why. Just they compared a public service announcement. This one specifically was anti-smoking. And then they had it like a YouTube video. And they had it with either no comments, with positive and civil comments, positive and uncivil comments, negative and civil, negative and uncivil, mixed positive and negative comments, or again, just no comments at all. And the one that had the greatest impact in terms of people remembering and liking the ad was the one with no comments at all. So any kind of comments, even positive and civil, had a negative effect on the take-home message.
Wow.
The authors speculate that this could be due to the fact that the comments are distracting. You know, people get into, you guys have read the comments to YouTube videos. They definitely destroy your confidence in humanity. I mean, they're soul sucking.
And actually there have been, although I guess civil makes the difference, but there have definitely been comments on my YouTube videos where like the person obviously supports me and I've just deleted them because they sound like complete idiots. So I've definitely seen examples of positive comments that can damage your cause.
They write words like cuz, C-U-Z, cuz, yeah. Cuz I'm thinking this. And
that's the least of my concerns,
cuz. Just cuz.
I'm talking like every other word misspelled and like terrible slurs for people with mental disabilities thrown in. So, yeah.
Yeah, they just... Yeah, I agree. I could totally see that. You know, just you get caught up in people just arguing with each other, and it may have absolutely nothing to do with the message itself. Somebody will make some kind of deeper political point about it. It's like, oh, yeah, that's because Obama sucks, and they start arguing about Obama. You know, it has absolutely nothing to do with whatever the blog post or video or PSA was about. So I totally get that. I do think that there are some situations where just no comments are the way to go. Okay, let's go on to number two. Scientists find that taking fever-reducing medication when sick with the flu increases the spread of the disease and leads to more flu-related deaths. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Oh,
great work this week, everyone. So yeah, you guys are basically correct. The increased deaths is because of the increased spread of the disease. Doesn't necessarily mean that you are more likely to die if you treat your fever. That the study did not show that. It's really just that it encourages the spread by about 5%. And but because there are millions of cases of flu and 30,000 to 40,000 people in the U.S. alone die every year from the flu, increasing the spread by 5% will cause about 1,000 extra deaths a year from people routinely treating their fevers. And Jay, you hit upon one effect that you definitely feel better when you treat the fever, and that may make people more sociable, which is a bad thing if you have the flu. May just put them over the edge where they think they can sort of muddle into work that day, which you really shouldn't do if you have the flu. You should stay home. But also, Bob is correct in that, or Rebecca, I can't remember who said this, that having a fever does make it harder for the virus to replicate. And
so I said that.
Your viral load, your viral load will be lower. So you'll be shedding fewer viruses and your infectivity will be less.
If you have
a fever. But having said all that, that doesn't necessarily mean that you should not treat your fever, because their fevers do have a downside as well, in that they can certainly contribute to dehydration. You can individualize the decision. You can decide whether or not you want to treat your fever. First of all, you don't feel like you have to, unless
what's too hot, Steve? What's a temperature that's dangerous?
Yeah, that's a good question.
110.
No, definitely. That's
go to the ER if you have a fever of 110. Like 104, 104 is considered a high fever, but even then, there's not really any conclusive evidence that it causes brain damage or that it causes any specific negative outcome. Definitely, up to 101, 102, I certainly wouldn't worry about it. Above that, I would get a little concerned, but again, the evidence is not clear. But if you really just feel terrible, go ahead and treat your fever. If you're having a hard time keeping well hydrated, go ahead and treat your fever. But the thing that you don't want to do is think that because you feel better, that you're therefore like not infectious or you can go to work. That's where the real problem comes from. So as long as you're not, the most important thing is isolation. And as long as you're doing that, it doesn't really matter how much virus you're shedding. The authors and the physicians that they quoted for the article about this were clear to say isolation is the key. that sort of trumps everything else. And treating the fever, yeah, it's not necessary, but if it makes you feel better and it may help you hydrate better, certainly don't suffer. Don't feel like you have to suffer through it because you need the fever to fight off the virus. That's probably not the case. All right. Let's go on number three. A new analysis concludes that U.S. carbon emissions can be reduced by 40% if all passenger vehicles by 2050 were fully electric. And clearly, I made this one too easy.
Clearly.
Because the 40 was too high. And that's fiction. It's totally. Do you know what percentage of carbon emissions come from passenger vehicles?
Like 15.
10%?
5 to 10?
20%. Good, Bob. 20%.
Yeah, baby.
So,
that's too high.
20% would be the theoretical maximum that it could possibly reduce carbon
emissions. It's still a large amount. It's still a decent amount of.
But
it's a lot of cars.
But Jay's right in that the big issue here is that if you're producing that electricity by burning coal, there's no advantage in terms of carbon emissions. And in fact, a recent study, an analysis, they looked at, they said, okay, if, let's say by 2050, it wasn't even 100%, like a significant percent of the cars are electric drive vehicles. So that includes hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and fully electric. And they found that it would have essentially no impact on our carbon emissions. It's just not the way to solve the problem. Unless, as you say, Jay, unless you also couple that with zero emission power plant generation, you know, if we're making energy with solar, wind, nuclear, whatever, you know, things that have zero carbon emissions, and that's what you're using to charge your battery, then yes, that will reduce emissions and other forms of pollution as well. It's not just about the CO2. Just focusing on electric drives, electric cars, in and of itself will not really have a significant impact. And in addition, you have to consider manufacturing the batteries, what kind of batteries are we making? You know, there's other costs involved, other than just burning fuel, environmental costs. So it's interesting, you know, to think that there's a lot of, I think, political focus on zero emission vehicles, but that in and of itself isn't the answer. It's not really going to have much of an impact. It needs to be part of a much broader, program where we're displacing, the burning of fossil fuels for energy with lower or zero emission energy sources, right? Like thorium, right? We need the thorium car.
Yes.
That will do
it.
Oh,
gosh, I can't wait.
5 years.
5 years, we'll have a thorium car.
Steve, yeah. I have a quick little comment about your 40% number that you threw at us. So here you go.
That's too getting high.
Yeah.
How's that?
You know what movie that's from, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Of course.
That's like one of those things.
Is it Full Metal Jacket? Is it
Full
Metal Jacket thing?
No.
Used cars.
Used cars. It's like one of those things that just never forgot that one phrase. That's too. it's in my head and it comes out every now and then. It's like always there, ready to come out.
Yeah. I never saw that either.
Did you ever see, Rebecca? Did you ever see John Carpenter's The Thing?
Yeah.
All right, you're redeemed.
Oh, thanks. Thank God.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I do, but last week I believe that I named the wrong author to the quote. The author's name that I did mention was Ingmar Stenmark, and it was actually Gary Player, according to several people that listened to the show.
The golfer?
Moving on. This is an offbeat quote sent in by Susan Gunhouse. That's your real name. This is a quote by Farley Mowat. Anybody know who Farley Mowat is?
Bob. Farley, no.
He's a Canadian author and environmentalist. Check this quote out. On my 70th birthday, I was asked how I felt about mankind's prospects. This is my reply. We are behaving like yeast in a brewer's vat, multiplying mindlessly while greedily consuming the substance of a finite world. If we continue to imitate the yeast, we will perish as they perish, having exhausted our resources and poisoned ourselves in the lethal brew of our own waste. Unlike the yeast, we have a choice. What will it be?
That's interesting. What do you think about that quote?
I like it. I mean, just, you know, pretty straightforward point, but I like the way that he paralleled it with the yeast. If you think about, you know, them in a petri dish, just consuming every resource there and then, you know, eventually dying from the fact that they're swimming in their own waste. It's pretty interesting.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doc.
Yeah, had nothing better to do.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.